they're doing it maybe more nicely, maybe more brown people are doing it, but essentially the day-to-day functions of the Ferguson Police Department is it's the same. And so it's not that we just have to fight the unconstitutional policing that's taking place or in the country. As we see in Ferguson, much of that policing is completely constitutional. And I just am grateful that long after the cameras have left, that there are people in that neighborhood, people in those neighborhoods who are fighting to continue to limit the power that the Ferguson Police Department has.
We're all speaking here in New York. It's clear the next mayor will be Eric Adams, a former police officer, who really has rejected the idea of prison police abolition. Very simply, in the last seconds we have, your response, Derica.
Oh, of course he does. Black political officials, black people running for office, they get to do this. They get to say, I'm black and I'm a part of law enforcement. I understand both sides. And unfortunately, they just create more legitimacy for the police to do very bad things to harmful people. So I would just ask people to not be fooled by black people who say they understand both sides, because there is no both sides. There is a system of oppression where people have the power to kill, to incarcerate, and to arrest. And there are people who are vulnerable to it, and the people have to resist that.
We have to leave it there, yes, okay, but I want to thank you so much, Derica Purnell, author of the new book, Becoming Abolitionist.
One day. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 7:59 a.m. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Rowland.
Seeing them politicians stealing things we'd be loving, you best be believing we've had it up to here with that compromise. Yakety 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 yak. We ain't fooling, we want the whole thing back. We want room for the buffalo, the grizzly needs some place to go. Roundup developers, move them on down the track. Jack. We.
There is no planet B. There is no planet blah. Blah, blah, blah. Blah, blah, blah. This is not about some expensive, politically correct green act of bunny hugging or blah, blah, blah. Build back better, blah, blah, blah. Green economy, blah, blah, blah. Net zero by 2050, blah, blah, blah. Net zero, blah, blah, blah. Climate neutral, blah, blah, blah. Our hopes and dreams drown in their empty words and promises.
And that was a little experimental radio there. Good morning, everybody. This is Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. And we don't yak, yak, yak or blah, blah, blah. But we do talk, and hopefully some of that talk inspires you to reflect and perhaps to act. My guest this morning, Karen Pickett, has been acting directly for over 45 years, and mainly with the Earth First Movement, but she had a lot of experience in activism before that. We are talking about 40 years of direct action and agitprop in defense of Mother Earth. And we have Karen Pickett online. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning, Paul.
So good, an oldie but goodie there, Dakota Sid and Travis Clifford. You remember them?
Oh, I sure do. I haven't heard their voices in a while.
Yeah. I kind of wanted to play the whole thing, but it was almost 3 minutes, and I wanted to get that yak, yak, yak leading into Greta Thunberg's blah, blah, blah as, I thought, a good introduction to kind of the spirit of Earth First and how it was born in the spirit of going against those who, you know, maybe talk to talk or didn't act to save what's left of our precious natural ecosystems. So, yeah, the reason we're doing this show is because I ran into you a few months ago at an Earth First gathering of some old timers, and you had a copy of the 40th anniversary edition of the Earth First Journal, which I snapped up and I've been reading, and realized that actually last year, so many anniversaries had to be put off because of COVID, including the 40th anniversary of the Earth First and the anniversary edition. And so you're now involved with the Earth First Journal, but let's talk about going way back. You weren't there at the very beginning, but maybe talk about how you got involved in activism kind of leading up to your joining the Earth First movement in the early 80s.
Sure, and I would also say that you know, I couldn't agree more with Greta, and I mean, you know, she put it so well with a few words, and basically, you know, the spirit of what she is saying, you know, the you know, carbon net zero and et cetera, blah blah blah, you know, a big part of what she's saying is, look, you know, this is the talk we've been talking, and it's all about compromises, and look at where it's gotten us. So I think that you know, there was very much in the spirit of saying there's no room for any more compromises, and that's one of the bases on which Earth First was founded, was no compromise in defense of Mother Earth. And I ran into that sentiment and Earth First as an organization in early 1983, and I was working at the Ecology Center in Berkeley, and I was an activist of sorts. I had gotten involved in grassroots advocacy and recycling, which actually recycling in back then in the 70s when I was doing it was a radical thing. But I, you know, was always feeling like there is something more. I haven't quite found my place, and I was a member of a lot of environmental organizations, and it was really just by happenstance that I ran into Earth First. It was one of the founders, Dave Foreman, who came into the Ecology Center and had a handful of publications and T-shirts and said, well, there's this new organization, which I had never heard of. You might want to check it out, and I'll come back and check in with you. And when I read the material, what really grabbed me was a piece that was essentially a piece about what biocentrism is as a philosophy and an approach, and an approach to activism as well. And I had kind of an epiphany that, you know, aha, this is the piece that was missing. So when he came back in, I said, okay, you know, if there's other people that think like this, where do I sign up? And I did, and proceeded to get involved with Earth First campaigns, of which there were very, very few at that point. The campaign that I got involved with was the Calmeopsis campaign in Southern Oregon, and we were stopping a road that the Forest Service was building through a wilderness area that would essentially eliminate it for wilderness designation, because it would be cut in half, and it was an illegal road. So that was my first civil disobedience out in the woods.
The famous Bald Mountain Road blockade.
Yes.
I think I was, I remember the photo. Look, I actually didn't get involved until 1986. And so I didn't actually see those issues of the Earth First Journal, but that was an early photo of a bunch of people. I guess it was you, Foreman, and Mike Rozelle blockading a bulldozer, was it? Or a pickup truck.
Yeah, well, that action that Dave and Mike were involved in was actually a different blockade, and the blockade that I was involved with was we were blockading a bulldozer, the road building equipment. After hiking in all night, we were, we were at the end of the road cut, so we were very deep into the wilderness, and spent a couple of days in jail. And then that was the week when we came out. It was the first Round River rendezvous that I went to, which was in Southern Oregon, and the annual gathering of Earth First. But the day that we got out of jail, our affinity group of six people got out of jail, there was a lawsuit that Earth First had filed along with a couple of other environmental groups for an injunction to stop the road. And the day that we got out of jail, the ruling came down in that lawsuit, and we won. So, it's an image that I have always held with me that where we stood out in the forest with the old growth Doug firs right behind us and all around us, and we were just standing at the very end of this raw road cut. This, wound, this gash in the earth, and where we stood that day was where the road stopped, because after our blockade, the lawsuit stopped it. So,
well, that was a nice introduction, because as you well know now and learned over the years, those victories are certainly not guaranteed. In fact, sometimes are few and far between, but nice to get one under your belt right off. Kind of an encouragement, huh?
Yes, and it was a powerful image to carry around with me, because it what it said to me was really the power of a small group of people, and or even the power of an individual, because what we were fighting was this giant bureaucracy and these ingrained systems and the corporations that made money off the timber sales on public land, and just that whole giant machine. And we were a tiny group of people, but we were an organization developing this strategy of doing direct action blockades in order to stop what was going on. So it not having been involved in direct action like that before, that was the message of that day, that six ragtag people could just be out there and actually put an end to it. And was not a permanent end. That's, I think it was David Brower that said, our victories are temporary and our defeats are permanent. And there's so many battles that keep coming back that we have to fight again and again, because that same area after a fire was open for salvage logging, and there we were, fighting the battle for that very same forest.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot to talk about. There's 4 decades worth. We're going to kind of maybe roughly go through decade by decade and then take on a number of themes that been sort of raised and brought up by the Earth First movement. But talk about the origins of it. The whole idea of playing that Dakota Sid song, "We Want the Whole Thing Back, Yakety Yak," is really does go to the origins of Earth First and the founders, who themselves had been mostly very involved in established national environmental organizations and trying to protect large areas of wilderness designation. There's some controversies around the whole concept of wilderness, which we can get into if we have time, but it's one of the few tools certainly at that time to actually protect large areas of basically largely undisturbed natural ecosystems, which are so fundamental to protecting species, protecting, now we see with climate change, protecting the integrity of the incredibly complex, interconnected life systems that we live within. So yeah, talk about just a sketch of the origins of Earth First.
Yeah, and I think it's true that people do look at wilderness differently these days. And we were working within the constructs of what existed at the time. And, you know, these days we're saying these areas, including, you know, some of the designated parks, should be given back to the indigenous people. And it's a really kind of a similar goal in terms of taking the land and the resources and, you know, the water out of the hands of the corporations and to stop commodifying all of these natural systems. But back then it was wilderness. It was called wilderness, and some of the founders, most of the founders, as you said, had been working for the mainstream environmental organizations in Washington, D.C., and had been engaged in what was then called the RARE 2 process, which was in taking an inventory of all the roadless areas in the lower 48 and then deciding what portion of those roadless areas should be protected. And, you know, there was somewhat of a recognition in doing that inventory in the first place that the development, the logging, the mining had really been done in kind of a willy-nilly way, and so maybe it was time to step back and look at what had been done, where we were at, and what we should do in the future. But the problem with what might have been a good idea was to take stock of things was the fact that the conclusion that they were the environmental organizations, not even the, you know, the government bureaucracy, the conclusions they were arriving at was that a very small percentage of those roadless areas should be given protection, which meant keeping the extractive industries out. And so there were people who kind of threw up their hands and said, you know, this is absurd. Why are we even doing the inventory if it's not going to result in protection for, you know, what's left that is the most valuable in the natural world? And they said there's got to be another way where the compromises aren't so large and immediate. And so that was a large part of the idea behind the founding of Earth First, was no compromise. And it was through the discussions that this small group of people was having at the time around, well, how do we live out that principle, that part of the discussion arrived at, you know, an assessment of the tactics that had been used, which were, you know, lobbying, writing to your representatives, and working through the system. Well, maybe that hasn't worked very well. What else can we do? And it was a discussion of direct action, which, you know, didn't start immediately. Basically, people were just talking to a lot of other people from mainstream groups and otherwise to see if this idea would flow, something different. But the third tenet of Earth First that was there in the founding discussions was the philosophy of biocentrism, that the reason there was no more room for compromise and the reason that radical action, i.e. direct action, was appropriate to take was based in this idea of the value of the natural world, and the fact that value did not lie in its utilitarian usefulness to human beings, but that there was intrinsic value in the earth herself and the species that inhabit the earth, and that's what was being lost in this balance.
Mm-hmm. So you talked about the the Bald Mountain Road blockade, which was one of the early, I don't know if it was the first, one of the early direct action campaigns. Direct action meaning basically putting yourself in between the forces of destruction and the natural ecosystem that you're trying to protect, whether it's, you know, the initial ones was basically, yeah, just sitting in a road and trying to stop people from coming in. And then it evolved over time. I got involved in November 1986 as a tree sitter at Brighton Bush. I guess that was kind of the Northwest became one of the hotbeds of Earth First activity. Maybe you could sort of give a quick overview of, you know, some of the stuff that was going on around the country after I give this little. But it really did become a real center actually it was the Cathedral Forest Action Group. That was like the first Earth First splinter group that developed, which is in itself an interesting story. But I ended up there at midnight at the a bridge there, the bridge over the Brighton Bush River or the Little North Fork of the Saniam. I should remember that. But anyway, and they said, oh, do you need we need one more. There's two people who had already gone up in trees. There had been three people. I guess Mike Jacobal and his partner at the time were maybe the first tree sitters, is 84, 85 in the middle Santiam. This is like, you know, you did one of the first road blockades, and then some of the first tree sits were further up in Oregon. And then, you know, then there's three tree sitters, and they came down after, I think, 3 days, and then there are three more tree sitters. They had two up, and they were asking for one more. And I said, oh, okay, I'll do it. Anyway. So that's how you got involved in these things at the time, and maybe still, and that was like one of the that's where, you know, that was where it for there, some of the actions were, you know, direct action, forest defense started to get really stronger local regional publicity, and then eventually national publicity. But yeah, talk about some of the other campaigns that were going on through the 80s.
Well, it's true that a lot was happening in the Pacific Northwest, and that's just, you know, it's where it happened to grow. But part of the reason for that is because if there was a focus on the forests, I mean, when people were looking at the large unprotected areas and the large areas of public land that many of which were on the chopping block and needed campaigns built around them. Those areas were in the Rockies and in the Pacific Northwest. And also the campaigns that were going on, like the Bald Mountain Road campaign, is what grew the movement, because of course this was before the internet. It was the visible actions and, you know, people talking to each other is really what fed this growth. And so there was a lot that was happening in Oregon. I mean, interestingly, there was immediately a simultaneous Earth First type of groups growing in Australia, and you know, it was really serendipitous. They did end up calling themselves Earth First, but they were fighting for the rainforest areas in New South Wales and the whole northeast coast area of Australia, and we became acquainted with John Seed, who was with the Rainforest Information Center down there, who was very much a proponent of deep ecology, which is really another name for a biocentric philosophy. And they had big actions down there. There were actually 700 people arrested in an action in Tasmania in the early 80s. I think that was 83 or 84. And there were also some smaller actions. We had a campaign in the Bay Area. We launched a boycott of Burger King because they were clearing forest in Central America for cattle range for the burgers that would it would end up on the Burger King menu. And we were working with Randy Hayes, who was founding the Rainforest Action Network at that same time. Back then it was essentially a one-person organization. And, you know, a lot of the things, small and larger campaigns that people launched at that time and later, but I think there were notable issues that people jumped into that were really a clarion call for campaigns that were much larger that came later. And Earth First, I think, didn't get credit for launching some of these campaigns, but nonetheless, it was the beginning. And, you know, for example, we had a demonstration against GMOs in California, and I think that was around 86. And you know, of course, now there's GE Trees campaign and there's anti-GMO campaigns all over the world. And it's not that nobody else was doing anything at that time, but, you know, we kind of made a splashy entrance on that issue because we used political theater and also a little bit of monkey wrenching that were they were growing strawberries that would be resistant to frost. It was called Frost Ban, and they were genetically engineered. And somebody in the dark of night went out and pulled the strawberries in the field where they were being grown. And then we held a press conference with a little bit of theater. We had a mad scientist promoting genetic engineering, and so it, you know, it made the news and people began talking about it. But that was true of the issue of old growth too. It was the direct actions and the antics and the banner hangings that got old growth forests in the news, and that, of course, you know, launched so many campaigns and a whole different mindset.
Mm-hmm. So I'm talking with Karen Pickett, a longtime Earth First activist who has also been involved in many other things throughout her career, her life. And she is now actually, did you work with the Earth First Journal before? You're working with the journal now,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, off and on, many times I had, you know, written action stories and just submitted all kinds of pieces to the journal over the years and, you know, tabled for the journal and that sort of thing. But I was actually on the editorial collective when the journal was in Missoula, Montana. I mean, not for a long time. I was a short-termer during that time. Twice, two different periods of time, and you know, but was always very closely connected with the journal and placed it as a priority. Just on a personal level, I feel that it's an integral part of the movement because the movement is so lacking in infrastructure. Our publication is really part of the glue that holds us together and is our communication tool amongst ourselves and is our outreach tool and all of those things, because we, you know, we don't have means to do that outreach and communication otherwise, except by, you know, physically getting together and communicating on the internet, which is not a great way to to organize cutting edge.
Yeah, I feel
strategies.
I have a Facebook page for this show, which is KBO Wednesday Talk Radio, and I do mention that periodically as a way of, you know, for people to ask questions and make comments during the program. They can also call 503-231-8187. That's a number. We're almost halfway through the show. Haven't invited people to call in, but you are welcome to call in at 503-231-8187. Anyway, but I find it more and more difficult to even utter the word Facebook, especially given what's going on now and how we're still so beholden to corporate America in so many ways. And increasingly, it seems, despite our most valiant efforts. But anyway, as I said, I'm talking with Karen Pickett, and we're talking about the history of Earth First. We've gotten through a few years of it. Hopefully, we'll get a little further. And we're talking about the Earth First Journal. And this is our fall membership drive for KBOO. And we are a self-funded organization, very similar in some ways to Earth First, which has always been largely self-funded, partly through the journal, through subscriptions, and selling it at tables, as Karen was talking about. KBOO's model is a listener-sponsored model. It's been going on for 52, 53 years now, successfully. We're having kind of a slow start to this fundraising drive, and we'd like to really pick up that up, if at all possible. And we'd like to offer both this really wonderful, large volume, actually. How many pages? Many pages of the 40th anniversary edition, 40 years of direct action of the Earth First Journal.
88 pages,
there you go.
And full of color and photos.
And a lot of, you know, stories of, you know, kind of little short bios of some people, a lot of stories of people who'd been involved and what they'd been doing, some reprints of articles, some great poetry.
And a lot of art and poetry as well.
Yeah. Anyway, so we're offering that. It's on my KBOO.fm Wednesday Talk Radio program page. I said for contributions of $60 or more for either that or a one-year subscription, which would be basically four copies of the journal for $60 or more. Yeah, I'll keep that $6 or more for the subscription, which is a $25 value. But maybe, you know, anything over $40 would $50 for the for this anniversary edition would be fine. But yeah, we'd like to get some people to go to kboo.fm, and hopefully this is already listed there. But you can also well, anything that comes in during the show, you will be asked if you want that. So you can just go to kboo.fm and click on donate, and you know, make your donation, and then you'll get one of these premiums, either the four issues, which is the equivalent of a one-year subscription. I know it's had a little bit of a rough time moving around a little bit the last half year, but I know now they're settled again, and they're coming out with their fall issue in just a couple weeks. Uh-huh. So you can get that fall issue as your first issue of the Earth First Journal if you get give us a contribution of $60 or more. Go to kboo.fm, or you can also text, let me get that up on the proper page here. Sorry, I'm even going off mic. Anyway, I'll get that information. I've got two computers going, and my mic is not where it should be to make it easy to do this. But anyway, you don't need to hear all that. But yeah, so please support both the Earth First Journal and KBOO Radio. 2-in-1. What a bonus. 2-in-1. It's our fall membership drive. This is how we make this station happen. This is a listener-sponsored radio station. 80% of our operating expenses comes from you, the listener. So you can step up, and you know, if you're not already a member, you can become a new member. If you are already a member and your membership is about to expire, you can re-up by going to kboo.fm KBOO.FM, or you can just make a one-time donation. We do love those monthly contributions taken directly out of your bank account. We can gladly accept those as well. And Karen, I know you know all about fundraising, don't you?
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's funny because our listener-sponsored station down here in the Bay, KPFA, the mighty KPFA and Pacifica Radio, they're in their fund drive now as well. And I promote our community radio stations, and in part because, we, who are activists, use them all the time. I mean, you know, it's part of the strategy of getting the word out about an issue, and part of moving campaigns forward is to use those means of communication. But I've done all kinds of fundraising, including, you know, fundraising for Earth First Direct Action.
It's it'd be an interesting thing to go into. We may not have time, but the whole, you know, issue that Earth First historically has engaged and has been, you know, pushing the envelope and taking risks and, you know, doing things that are sometimes not according to the written laws as they stand. And So it creates a certain, possibly some difficulties for fundraising. It certainly, as you know, you got yourself in jail. I got myself in jail a couple times doing actions. Since the corporate America has the legal system often in its pocket, there's sometimes really no other way around shaking up the system than doing such things, it seems at times. But let's get back to the trajectory of Earth First. I mean, it was really astounding. If you look back in the 80s, you know, from like one group, I guess, centered in Tucson, Earth First originated in the Southwest U.S. It kind of came to the Northwest early on through the Bald Mountain Road campaign, and then other campaigns further north, and then boom, you know, Washington State, Idaho, California, you know, went from a few handful of local groups to basically groups in just about every state of the United States, and then across the world, right?
Internationally, absolutely, and you know, Earth First has always been, decidedly non-hierarchical and very decentralized, and that, you know, that was the model from the word go. People kind of gathered in the Southwest so that they could put out a publication, but not so that they could be like the central voice or the central office for Earth First. And I think it's not a unique model. It's not something that Earth First invented, this decentralized model, but I do believe it works and dovetails with people's feelings about egalitarianism and democracy. And you know, there's been many spawns, if you will, of Earth First, and because there's no one way to promote the biocentric, no compromise stance in terms of defending the natural world. And really, from the very early days, you know, there have been spin-offs from Earth First, of people that either wanted to focus on things in a different way or focus on a particular geographic area. But organizations that some of whom got quite large, like, you know, the Center for Biological Diversity, of course, whose focus is litigation, and defending species that way, but they have, you know, they operate true to their biocentric roots in that they look at habitat issues and they look at the other species that we share the planet with. But they were, CBD was founded by Earth Firsters, and
of course one of them, I won't out them publicly, but one of them,
well, their photo is in the in the anniversary.
Anyway, it was a okay. Well, Peter, I won't name your last name, but anyway, was one of our Stumptown or Portland Earth First activists.
Great.
Yeah. Anyway, so yeah, I mean, the people went on to do just the Portland group. The people went in to do all kinds of different things.
Right, there's like the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project and the Global Justice Ecology Project, which is in the Northeast, kind of, you know, spun off Earth Firsters working together, and the Ruckus Society and Rising Tide North America, the Buffalo Field Campaign, and you know, and even groups that took a, if you want to call it a more hardcore stance, the groups that went underground, like the Earth Liberation Front and the Animal Liberation Front, it was, I wouldn't necessarily call them spin-offs of Earth First, but, you know, certainly based in the same philosophy, and it was kind of a parallel strategizing and a parallel organizing, while Earth First was organizing the above ground direct actions, you know, at mining sites and in the forests. So it's, you know, and I think that diversity in the landscape, you know, everybody from the Center for Biological Diversity to underground groups is something that, for one thing, it drives the authorities crazy, but which is always a good thing. But you know, we need that so that everybody has a place, for one thing, but there's no one strategy. There's no one, you know, we'll do a road blockade, we'll do a tree sit, we'll invade public hearings and dress up in costume like wildlife. You know, we have to stay on the cutting edge. We have to stay creative and open to new tactics and strategies, just in order to keep up with what we're opposing, because the same things do keep coming back at us. And you know, it's just, when I was listening to the news this morning before this show, you know, there's all this news of the oil spill in Southern California, which is, it's devastating, it's tragic, but you know, all I can think of is, you know, how is this that we humans are so incapable of learning? You know, when I was talking about my beginnings before I discovered Earth First, working for the Ecology Center in Berkeley, it was the oil it was an oil spill in Southern California that really that launched the Berkeley Ecology Center in 1969. Because people did organizing around cleaning off the birds that were subjected to the oil and that spill that was around the Santa Barbara area, and you know, there's all these offshore rigs in the Gulf that are unused pipes that are leaking, and so. You know, it speaks to the fact that we can't decide on a strategy or an approach and figure, you know, this is what we're going to use to oppose this kind of activity and put an end to it.
Well, I just got to interrupt because we only have about 15 minutes left, And we've covered about 3% of what we're going to do, but that's inevitable. That often happens on this program because there's so much going on. There's so much history. But, you know, you mentioned ELF, and that's something we had talked about privately, and I just can't let that go without just not going into a long conversation, because I do want to talk about a few other things. But, yeah, I was against the emergence of the ELF at the time. I thought we just weren't ready for that level of intensity, and it ended up having such a negative effect on the overall movement, in my opinion, that I think it was basically a disastrous mistake. And I think that I think there needs to be a lot more reexamination of that period. But we can kind of leave it there. I just, you know, there's a term called adventurism used kind of in leftist or Marxist analysis, which basically when people kind of break off too and go too far, too fast, too far ahead of, you know, certainly the general public, and really, you know, in my opinion, too far ahead of the movement, what the movement itself was capable of. I've said this publicly before. You know, I think, just speaking speculatively, if one could actually dismantle a pipeline with thousands of people surrounding the site, that's the kind of action that I'd like to see. I'd like to see building up to larger mass actions that are able maybe to do some of the same things that some of those underground groups. Because, you know, the model of ELF was basically, let's just do all these things and then everybody will, you know, imitate us and will cause massive economic damage. And that basically just didn't really happen. In a few cases, it had some success. But overall, I think there wasn't an overall strategy. But anyway, we can just leave that there. So I wrote here in this on the program page that the movement not only brought a biocentric perspective to wider public consciousness and raised the visibility of efforts to protect natural ecosystems, it helped re-inject the spirit of direct action into broader movements for social and environmental justice. And I think that's really true. I think I've heard the same thing from Earth Firsters in the UK, that sort of the whole idea of direct action, you know, coming from some like the women's disarmament camps and stuff like that, it sort of waned. And then Earth First, you know, this can be, you know, just from decade to decade because things happen so fast. But, you know, things can kind of wane, the whole spirit of the 60s. I mean, Greenpeace was sort of in some ways, an exception. They kind of operated often very far from where most people lived and kind of with just these small bands of, you know, squads of people. But Earth First had some of the similar spirit, but ended up, as we're talking about, really having large, you know, having hundreds, even thousands of people being active in particular actions. And as I even heard from one guy from ACT UP, the group that was, you know, trying to get some justice on the AIDS issue and get some, you know, real research and get that, he actually said that they were partially, you know, somewhat inspired by Earth First. Just the fact that someone was doing direct action inspired other people. I don't know if that's like how much truth there is, but I think that's, you know, when people rise up, other people see that, and it's an example.
Yeah, it's really true, and I think, you know, in the earlier days, I think it was something that set Earth First apart, and that became less true. And certainly in today's landscape, you know, so many groups, so many people. I mean, you know, direct action is almost a commonplace strategy, and civil disobedience is certainly a commonplace strategy. And it's direct action and civil disobedience are not tactics that Earth First invented in any way, shape, or form. And I think that, you know, some of the in the early direct actions, we were studying earlier movements as well, in order to get better and in order to train other people so that they would be prepared for the consequences and that sort of thing. But I think that it's something that has always, we can at least claim partial credit for inspiring, and in many movements, and including these offshoots, and also the long-term campaigns like Headwaters Forest and Warner Creek and Mount Graham in Arizona and Cove Mallard in Idaho. You know, Earth First also became known for these campaigns that were direct action campaigns, but they were also places where people really dug in their heels and kind of moved in, and out of that evolved the whole free state idea of a way to carry out a campaign. And so it wasn't, you know, Greenpeace is more known for like its quick hits, you know, it'll move in with all its technology and money and hang this banner, you know, up in Seattle when they were stopping the Shell oil tankers from going out and that sort of thing. But these, these campaigns that where people just kind of moved into the area and dug in their heels with the intention of staying until there was some kind of a change was something that was, it was kind of an Earth First brand, and I think that that really inspired people, too, to take responsibility for the work that they were doing and the area and the species that they were there to defend.
So before we wrap up, we have about 10 minutes left, and I wanted to go back to our own having hunkered down here in this little building here at Southeast 8th Avenue, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, to be exact, if you want to send us a check. 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. That's where we're at. That's where I'm at. Still very little in-station activity, but this us hosts who want to do it are able to come in, which is nice. It's a break from still largely hunkering down at home, as where most of us are still doing. But yeah, we've hunkered down here, and we are tearing apart our air room and rebuilding it, thanks to our engineer Arthur and other people. And you know, all that takes money. The electricity takes money. Keeping our staff going, keeping our equipment maintained. And doing these upgrades, we need some serious upgrades here. And in order to do that, it does take money. Everything takes money, it seems like. But KBOO.FM is where you go, www.kboo.fm/give, or text KBOO to 44321. That's 44321 on your mobile device. And as I said, you can also mail it in, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. And we do have a couple premiums. You know, usually we've been saying this a lot. You know, we have our back room full of volunteers and the phones ringing and lots of activity, conviviality, and all that sort of thing. And we're going to get back there someday. But right now, we don't have that. And the way to get to us is through our website, kbo.fm. And we don't have a whole lot of premiums, but we do have copies of this 40th anniversary edition of the Earth First Journal, which is yours for $40 or more. And we have a subscription to the Earth First Journal, which is going to come out with its fall issue for the first time after a few months hiatus. And you can get that issue and three more for $60 or more. And, you know, if you just go to KBOF.FM or go to our, you know, text KBOO to 44321. And if you're registered as having contributed during this show, you will be contacted as to which of those that you want. Also easy. But please do contact us. And yeah, we got about 5 minutes left. We got Karen Pickett. Looks like we might have a caller on the air. Len, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Paul. How are you doing?
Well, go ahead.
Say, I got to say, I'm pretty disappointed, not to say embarrassed. I mean, here you guys, everything's happening on the Earth now. incredible danger it's in. I mean, the U.S. government just, you know, admitted there's 23 species went extinct, when we know there's like that many go extinct every day, plus the oil issue that was alluded to. And, you know, this ain't, you're talking about nostalgia, man. I mean, there's no nostalgia. There's nothing to, for anybody to pat themselves on the back for. You know, I mean, we're in deep stuff. And, you know, the old Earth first in the 80s would be screaming bloody murder and have to hit campaigns going against it and be on the spear point there. I know, bad war metaphor, right? But,
well, let's let Karen talk about some of the campaigns that are going on right now then, since you brought it up. Go ahead, Karen.
Well, the what Earth First people are involved in these days is really jumping into coalitions with other people and with a lot of indigenous groups on the pipeline campaigns. I mean, that's what is just in the landscape that's out there now. That's what I see. I went to an Earth First gathering this summer, a national gathering, and most of the people there were focused on the Line 3 campaign up there in Minnesota, and certainly other pipeline campaigns, the one in British Columbia. And I, you know, for me, it's not nostalgia. Just seeing that there is a history, you know, there have been campaigns where we have had some success, and that's the reason to keep going, and the only point is to keep going. And there are hardly any like dedicated Earth First local groups these days where there used to be a lot. So what people are doing is joining in coalition and being allies in these other larger campaigns. And so it's, you know, fitting into the landscape, whatever that current landscape is. And these days it's a lot about, you know, removing petroleum from our lives and fighting these pipelines and fighting these energy companies who are not going to, they're not the ones that are going to change to renewable sources. So the issue has to be forced, and a lot of these campaigns are not only using direct action, but are using some of the strategies that I think should be credited to Earth First. Our Earth First Direct Action Manual is used by campaigns all over the place, and that's one thing that we have brought to the table and contributed to the larger campaigns, and people are working on a new edition now. So, you know, it's always about devising new strategies, getting better, getting more creative, figuring out who else we can work with and how we can work with them. And that's the name of the game, not nostalgia.
Okay, well, thank you for calling, Lynn. I don't think we have time for any more callers. The 40th anniversary issue is just chock full. I mean, history is not nostalgia. History is understanding where we came from and understanding, you know, I just think it's important to acknowledge the history and acknowledge where we came from, and then to move on. And then, of course, then there's the current Earth First Journal, which is still an organ for a movement. It's a way to find a plug into what's going on. And, you know, the only way to support it is to support it. And, maybe start local Earth First groups again, or start other groups. You know, there's never enough action. There's never enough activism. There's never enough people doing what needs to be done. We're always stretched thin, you know, both Earth First and KBOO Radio. So I guess that's just a final appeal for people to support both Earth First and KBOO Radio. Go to kboo.fm or text 44321 to KBOO. As I said, we're kind of slow on this pledge drive. I don't know if it's just COVID weariness or people are financially strapped. I'm sure all those are true. But I'm sure there's some people who listen and have the capability, and I wish you would dip in. So, Karen, how to sum up 40 years of Earth First, especially since we barely got through the history. But, you know, I don't know. Talk about what you're thinking these days. What's keeping What's keeping you going?
Well, the fact that, you know, there's always something to turn to. I mean, you know, I'm sending out a press release tomorrow about forest activists up on the coast in Northern California defending the old growth in the state forest up there. And there's another campaign on the coast as well in the Mattole Forest. And, you know, where PG&E is cutting trees in Humboldt Redwood State Park. And, you know, so these things are going on all around us. And you know, if you're paying attention and keeping an open mind and keeping your
so plug in, as
your
you're
eyes
saying.
Open.
But we got to run, Karen. Sorry, we have 30 seconds left. So yeah, plug into KBOO is one place to do it, and the Earth First Journal. Thank you, Karen Pickett, so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Paul.
Bye, everybody.
We want room for the buffalo. The grizzly needs some place to go. Roundup developers.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 8:59. Next up, we have Fight the Empire.
Well, good morning. This is Fight the Empire on KBOO, your radio station, the station that belongs to you and me and the people, all the listeners, and it's up to us to keep this station going.